You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, welcome to Brookings. My name is Ron Haskins, and along with Belle Sawhill, I run the Center on Children and Families here. Belle gave me careful instructions before we came in to talk slowly, which I'm not going to do because we're in a hurry. You have bios for everybody, so I'm going to give very brief introductions. I want to talk more about the substance of our event and of the administration's policy than introducing the speakers. So I think the most important thing to say is that the Obama administration has been the most venturesome, maybe the most risky in its education policy of any president, I think, in my lifetime, in their attempt to improve education in America. The race to the top provided well over $4 billion for innovative practices in K-12 education on a competitive basis, so it didn't go to every state. This caused a lot of heartache. And then second, investing in innovation, the so-called I-3, investing in innovation, is bringing evidence of successful education programs and rigorous evaluation to center stage in education programming. So along with the huge impact of the Institute of Education Sciences on educational research under Russ Whitehurst's wonderful leadership, and Russ will be on the second panel, literally, for the first time, we are building an evidence-based series of educational practices that hold great promise for improving K-12 education. The imagination and leadership, not to mention the political boldness, of Secretary Duncan and his team are directly responsible for much of this progress. Now the Secretary and President Obama are proposing the biggest increase in preschool education funding since the creation of Head Start in 1965. We've organized this event to examine both the substantive and political prospects for this vitally important initiative. We'll first hear from Secretary Duncan about the preschool plan and the arguments on its behalf. And then following Secretary Duncan, we'll hear from Nancy Johnson, the former chair of the Human Resources Subcommittee for Ways and Means, and one of the most knowledgeable Republicans on social policy to serve in Congress in recent years. I once said that, introducing Mrs. Johnson, someone in the audience yelled out, "That's no achievement," but we'll... In 24 years in Congress, Mrs. Johnson was a leading expert on preschool programs as well as health care and played a vital role in passage of the refundable portion of the child tax credit. We thank them both for coming. Secretary Duncan.
Well, thank you so much, Ron, and Brookings for hosting this discussion about President Obama's landmark proposal for high-quality preschool. And you guys have been great supporters of high-quality preschool. Thank you so much. And I'm so happy to have the chance to listen to Congresswoman Johnson. Didn't know, grew up in the same neighborhood, went to the same school, K-12, and so maybe not so surprising that we agree on these kinds of issues. But thank you so much for your hard work throughout your entire career. As all of you know, and as Ron talked about, the President has proposed a groundbreaking plan for supporting and preparing our nation's children from birth through the age of five in a seamless continuum of opportunity. For children ages 0 to 3, the President's proposal includes a new Early Head Start Child Care Partnership at the Department of Health and Human Services to improve quality, and it expands the administration's home visiting initiative. And home visiting is showing great results. As anyone who's ever had to care for a new baby knows, we all need all the help and advice that we can get. And that's often especially the case for struggling single parents, first-time parents, and teenage parents. For four-year-olds, the President's proposal would create a new federal-state partnership to enable states to provide voluntary, universal, high-quality preschool for children from low and moderate-income families. These are critical long-term investments in early learning that our country and our children desperately need. They are the best, most effective tool we have to close both achievement, and I like to talk about those opportunity gaps, to close both the achievement and the opportunity gaps. We know that children from low-income families begin school, on average, 12 to 14 months behind their peers in language development and pre-reading skills. They start school as a five-year-old in the fall, already behind, and often, as we know, they actually never catch up. We know that nationwide, for those children who are lucky enough to enroll in a preschool program, fewer than 3 in 10 four-year-olds, less than 30%, are in programs that are of high quality. Simply put, the current status quo is both morally and educationally unacceptable. And from a long-term economic competitiveness standpoint, it's actually just plain dumb. The United States badly lags behind other nations in supporting early learning. Out of 29 industrial nations, the U.S. devotes less public spending to early learning as a percentage of GDP than 24 of our competitors. And the United States is actually 28th among OECD nations in our enrollment of four-year-olds in early learning. Simply not good enough. That's an embarrassment, and it's a missed opportunity for a huge return on investment. Rigorous, longitudinal work by folks such as Nobel Prize-winning economist James Heckman, also at the University of Chicago, found a return of $7 to every $1 of public investment in high-quality preschool programs. Children who went to preschool have fewer special needs as they move through school. Less go into special ed. They get better jobs. They have better health, and they commit less crime. A 7-to-1 ROI. That's a much better return than any of us would typically get in the stock market, in real estate, or anywhere else that we can put our money. Obviously, no study is perfect or fully represents our diverse nation. But the cumulative evidence over four decades is absolutely compelling. High-quality preschool gives children the foundation they need to succeed, not just in school, but in life. And let me just briefly mention a couple other examples. Four-year-olds who have gone through Tulsa, Oklahoma's preschool program start kindergarten 7 months ahead in pre-literacy skills and 4 months ahead in math skills. The Tulsa program has small class sizes and well-trained teachers, both features of President Obama's proposal. A recent evaluation of the Great Start Readiness program in Michigan found that 58% of the state preschool participants graduated from high school on time, 58%, compared to 43% of non-participants from similar backgrounds. And the impact of Michigan's preschool program on-time graduation rates was even larger among students of color, 60% versus 37%. Think about the power of that, almost doubling high school graduation rates. And in New Jersey, the follow-up to the Abbott preschool program, a study continues to find that high-quality preschool programs increase achievement in language arts and literacy, math, and science through fourth and fifth grade. Despite all the evidence, dramatically expanding high-quality preschool poses real challenges. And these days, getting folks here in Washington to do anything productive together, quite frankly, is a challenge. But for all that reality, for all the dysfunction we see here in Washington, I'm actually confident. I'm confident, I'm hopeful that these challenges can be met because I see the leadership already across the country from Republicans and Democrats and independents. 27 governors, more than half our nation's governors, as well as the mayor of D.C., reference early learning in their State of the State addresses this year. These state leaders, regardless of party affiliation, recognize that early learning helps prepare young children for educational success, provides crucial support for families, and ultimately strengthens our nation's economy. As Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper said in his State of the State address, early childhood education is one of the best investments we can make to ensure Colorado's kids are competitive and prepared for the future. Washington's Governor Jay Inslee also gets it. He said, and I quote, "We need to invest more where we get the biggest return in high-quality early learning programs." Governors from states as diverse as Hawaii, Indiana, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Michigan, Missouri, Ohio, Vermont, and West Virginia, all of them, all called for expanded access for preschool for more of our nation's four-year-olds. And when I talked to Alabama Governor Robert Bentley, a Republican, after the president unveiled his preschool proposal at the State of the Union, Governor Bentley told me he felt the president had stolen many of his best lines. So clearly we owe him one, and so I want to quote from Governor Bentley. And he said, "I truly believe by allowing greater access to a voluntary pre-K education, we will change the lives of children in Alabama." And Governor Bentley isn't just talking. He is absolutely walking the walk. Just last week, he signed a bill investing more than $28 million in Alabama's preschool program to provide 1,500 more children with access to high-quality preschool. And we're seeing many other governors working hard in providing real leadership to do what's right for their kids and ultimately for their states. Governor Susana Martinez says this year the state will be able to support all 40 preschool programs across New Mexico that applied for funding. And she recognizes that to get a child reading by the end of third grade, you must start exposing them to books, letters, and sounds long before they enter school. This Friday, I'll be traveling to Georgia, our nation's first universal preschool program for four-year-olds, in a state that President Obama highlighted as a leader for high-quality preschool when he visited Georgia in February. In Atlanta, I'll be standing with Governor Deal, another Republican who made a promise in his State of the State address that he recently, like Governor Bentley in Alabama, that he recently kept. Governor Deal requested, and the legislature recently approved, a $13 million increase in pre-K funding to add 10 additional days to the preschool year and increase the salaries of deserving teachers. That is state leadership that helps children. And that's exactly what the president's proposal seeks to support. The Preschool for All plan would help all states keep their promises to our children and ensure that more than a million additional kids, regardless of zip code or family background or income, are ready to succeed in school and beyond. Now, I've had the opportunity recently to visit preschool classrooms all over the country, including Delaware, California, and most recently in Michigan. Governor Rick Snyder and I visited the Perry preschool program in Ypsilanti, where 50 years ago, a group of preschoolers first participated in a famous study that has found preschool's benefits continue well into the adult years. In Detroit, Governor Snyder and I sat scrunched together in tiny chairs and read the book The Rainbow Fish to four-year-olds, who were fortunate enough to be getting an outstanding, high-quality preschool program. And like other governors, Governor Snyder tells me there are not enough programs to meet the real need in his state of Michigan. Yet, despite tough budgets and difficult economic times, these governors and many, many others are absolute champions for young children. They are prioritizing early learning because they know that in America, education must fulfill its role as the great equalizer. It must be the one force that overcomes differences in race, in privilege, in national origin. In Washington, we are ready to follow their lead and support their efforts to transform the life chances of our nation's children. We're asking Congress to help support these governors in all the states in the historic federal-state partnership. The President's Birth to Five proposal is not only an essential investment to build a foundation for prosperity and entry into the middle class, it is simply the right thing to do. As Governor Corbett said in his State of the State address this year, why do we want to spend more on these programs? Because every child in Pennsylvania deserves an equal start in life, and I intend to see that promise kept. Like Governor Corbett, I believe that every child in America deserves an equal start in life, in rural America, in our cities, and in our suburbs. So let's invest to bring every child to the same starting line. Help us get our nation's public schools out of the catch-up business. Let's keep our promises and reinvigorate the nation's commitment to equal opportunity. It's time. Our children and our country, we cannot wait. Thank you so much. I look forward to the questions later. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. I've admired you the years that you've been secretary. It's been a great asset to the nation to have someone who really has been at the front line in a city like Chicago and who respects the art of teaching as well as the art of parenting and the need for autonomy, a certain degree of autonomy of the systems throughout the country. Before I ran for Congress, I served in the State Senate of Connecticut. And before that, I was an extremely active parent in the children's school system and led many initiatives to improve our public schools in a town that's just like Chicago, but smaller. But all the ethnic diversity, all the problems, and there's just so much we can do, and I think the vision that the president has is exactly the right vision. And it's one that we've struggled with as a nation for many years, and our 0-3 program has actually saved the lives of many a child if you look at them as whole human beings. Some of the other things that we've done have really made big strides. So looking now at that whole 0-5 as the challenge is really the right thing to do. I would just say that as a very locally footed person, And also, as chairman of the Human Resources Subcommittee of Ways and Means, that does, frankly, all the social services legislating outside of the Education and Labor Committee, I'm very, very conscious of the extraordinary diversity of infrastructure, philosophy, and vision of our states. I mean, we did lots of work in foster care. It took us a year and a half to get the Education and Labor Committee to have a joint hearing with the Human Resources Committee on worker training when we were doing welfare and how do you help women get off welfare. So the silo issue is not to be underestimated. In my district, there were a third of the towns had a smaller population than a battleship does. And they had to give up on some of the federal programs that they were entitled to because they really couldn't handle the administrative burden. We have Head Start. We have early school readiness. Connecticut has, and each state has its own Head Start equivalent and Early Start and preschool programs. So it is irresponsible, and it is irresponsible not to bring the thinking of smart government to the table of preschool. It's not only that we have some programs like home visiting and birth to three that are very successful. There are programs in New York City and in the rural parts of Connecticut that aim at the same population that are very successful. So I hope we don't bring to this, Mr. Secretary, too narrow a vision of what preschool education should be. I'm also the grandmother of two daughters who both held their children back from entering kindergarten for a year to everybody's great advantage and success. So just keeping in mind the extraordinary capability of communities, if they have the resources, and how close they are to the diverse needs of their own people, so that we don't want to be too rigid. I mean, one of the programs that was most successful in the schools of New Britain, which were really as having as great difficulties as any in the country, was the fact that a group of teachers could ask for federal money to help them do what they needed in their classroom. And one principal in the first really heavily Hispanic school in my district said to me, I don't even go to their meetings anymore because I squelch their ideas, or at least they feel that. So don't underestimate the power that as the president talks about this and as you talk about this, what will happen out there in the hinterland. And don't let this become another silo. In fact, you have the power to do what has been done in some other areas. It was federal power that changed how communities dealt with homelessness because you couldn't get any more money from HUD unless your community put themselves to the task of not only how do you shelter, but how do you provide education, how do you provide health care for a homeless person, how do you look at the whole person. So we have to look not just at the child for whom coming to kindergarten is absolutely essential if they're going to have a successful life. But we have to look at the family. Because the more the mother can become involved, and we have some school programs that do this, so we can build on them. All the siblings of the kids who are in grade school want to go to grade school. It's a big deal. And if the mother and the children are allowed to come, and if those programs couldn't adjust for working mothers, you educate the child, but you educate the mother in that crucial year of 4 years old and 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. And so I think we can't have just the classroom model in mind, as important as that is. And I think Republicans are very interested in preschool education, and not just Bennett. I know lots of Republicans who are, Governor Rell, the former governor of Connecticut, tried hard to initiate a universal preschool program and couldn't get the legislature to go along. So it's not a question of the vision, although it is, and the leadership of putting forward the vision, absolutely, hugely important to change. But we have to build on the blocks that are there, and in every state there are successes. And if states could just begin by doing an inventory of success, regardless of where it resided or under what program name, that state would know a lot more about how they can achieve your goals. So I just wanted to congratulate you on the vision. I want to thank you and the president for your leadership. and I hope that you will not contribute yet another silo to the silos that are, in my mind, the biggest impediment, and I say that thoughtfully, the biggest impediment to real change. The children have already changed. They learn differently. Look at the way they use all those, all that technology that's such a struggle for me. And so the way they are going to learn, the way they are going to share with each other, the way they are going to move along is different. And since they always did learn differently, those technologies will take advantage of that and feed to it, and so must our teachers. I like the idea, though, of this partnership. I like your emphasis on mastery excellence of preschool teachers and coaching. All that coaching could be translated into a non-classroom setting as well. So thank you for being here, and I look forward to the panels.
So, Mrs. Johnson, you'd be glad to know the first thing I want to ask about, and that I agree with you is crucial, is this issue of silos. So we have a huge amount of money in Head Start. We have a fairly substantial amount of money in daycare. The states have close to $5 billion in state pre-K programs. We have Title I. We have early Head Start. So if you put it all together for early childhood, there's probably about $30 billion out there between the federal government and the states. Is there anything, is it part of your vision that you're going to make it easier for states to coordinate these programs? And in particular, I've constantly heard from states, most recently yesterday, and one of our panelists will talk about this, that Head Start is often difficult to coordinate with for state preschool programs and other states' money for the preschool area. So what is your vision of how you can help use this initiative to knit these programs together and make it easier for the states?
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree with the premise that historically the silos have been a huge barrier to children's success and opportunity. And those silos, frankly, start here in Washington. And I will tell you, Kathleen Sebelius and I, my good friend and partner in HHS, have spent an inordinate amount of time together. We've jointly administered the Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge, which has never happened before. She started calling me her work husband. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I think we're demonstrating in both a very real and also symbolic way that that dysfunction, those days are over. And we are joined, literally joined to hip. We have days where we do breakfast together and lunch together. And then she asks, what are we doing for dinner? The goal here is just really simple, that HHS would focus on the 0 to 3. We would focus on 4. And the goal would be to have children entering kindergarten at 5. Ready to be successful. So whatever ideas folks have of things we continue to improve to coordinate, but again, through programs we've already done together, I think we're cutting through those silos in a very real way. People are feeling that at the state level, at the local level. She and I addressed the Head Start National Association Conference a couple weeks ago together. And for all that investment that we're making, at the end of the day, the fact still remains that less than 3 in 10 four-year-olds have access to high-quality pre-K. So there's tremendous unmet need out there. That's what we have to meet. We need to meet it efficiently and thoughtfully and productively, but to act like there's enough money to help all the kids who need it today, that's simply not the case. We have tremendous, tremendous number of families and kids who need more than what they have available.
Nancy, you want to add anything to that?
No, I think it's, okay. Well, I should add one thing. That's very interesting what you say about you and the secretary. What I worry about is that little rural school,
yeah.
And it doesn't get down.
Yeah.
And the states are incredibly bureaucratic, and they take the bureaucracy you put in, then they imitate it, yeah. And repeat that. And then, so it is very serious, and if you could perhaps put more public stress on that and talk to states and governors, go to the Governor's Association, and maybe be more specific, because both parties talk about smart government, but nobody does much about it. So I'm glad to hear that. All I can say is faster forward.
Yeah.
So, Nancy, this bill is not going to pass unless it gets through the House. And it seems that the House especially, but to some extent the Senate as well, the Republicans are determined to stop almost everything that the president wants to do. Do you see any prospect that Republicans could sign on to not only a preschool program that spends $75 billion, but also a tax increase on a sin tax, granted, but still So what are the prospects that the House would come around and enter into negotiations, do something serious, not accept it as it is, but like in the old days, let's have a negotiation. Do you see that happening?
Absolutely, it's possible. If you look at what's happening about the exchanges, I was fascinated to find that the deals that are being made have to do with allowing states to offer the people above 100% of poverty, up to 138%, the right to be on the exchange and use the Medicaid money to be in the exchange. But get this, because this is the critical thing. They're allowed to offer them programs. Now, Medicare does not allow this. They're allowed to offer them programs that reward wellness, reward sticking to your regimen if you're a diabetic, reward health, and serious lifestyle changes. Now, those kinds of plans are proving all over the employment sector to save money and improve people's lives. But Medicare explicitly does not allow any variation in copayments and so on and so forth. So the structure of Medicare doesn't allow the assistance and support and the provision of special supports to people who need it the most. And so I was very interested. This was explicit in one of the states that recently made the agreement that they could offer these kinds. I think it was Iowa. So if we could just do that now rather than later, that way we don't use the word block grant, which everybody seems to hate. But actually, you've got to have far more state flexibility and autonomy. And it's a time when you could actually say, we will eliminate the requirements here if you'll eliminate those in your state grants. And so the money gets right down. It's a big deal. It is complicated. But you could work all kinds of deals with the states to do this. And if you could get two or three models out there with the states that does evidence the next world of collaboration in a federalist system, because I myself have been astounded at the absolute intransigence of the concept of federalism when you think how much it has changed from where we are now to, you know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago. And I think with this secretary's experience, he could do that. So I think if we could model that, then the issue of how much is going to be saved administratively at the state level and the federal level gets folded into funding this. And then if you need a little extra money, you can get a little extra money. But you can't start out and just pass a new tax for a new mandate for 4-year-olds to go to school.
But here's a shocker. You can't get any of those wonderful benefits unless the House approves the legislation.
Well, that's why the House...
So my question is, why are you optimistic about the House doing it?
Because I think there's a kind of a bipartisan approach that could be taken and needs to be taken at the beginning, not at the end of the process. Front load it, and I think you'll have support.
So there's an advisor to...
I'm right with her. I'm talking to a number of congressional House Republicans who are interested. And again, you have an opportunity here that doesn't normally exist. We talked a lot about the bipartisan, you know, governor support. You have many CEOs, many of whom happen to be Republicans, who are hugely supportive because they see the ROI. You have military generals, military leaders who are fully supportive. You have state's attorneys and police chiefs who love this because they know the reductions in crime. Faith-based community, parents. You can build a very, very interesting coalition that doesn't exist on most issues that transcends all the silliness here. So, again, anything productive these days is definitely a heavy lift. Mm-hmm. But if there's going to be any area where folks can come together, I think this one is ripe. And there are these unlikely allies that make me think there's a real opportunity.
You mentioned several Republican governors. I know you visited the state already, and you're soon going to Georgia. And I understand from your talk and from your staff that you've talked with other Republican governors. Do you see that there's a way that you could use Republican governors, or that they – of their own volition would try to influence their representatives from their state and the senators to vote to support something like this?
So, again, we're having conversations with governors and their staff, but these guys aren't just talking. They're walking the walk. They are making these investments. They are trying to put, you know, in tough economic times, real dollars behind this. But, you know, folks like Governor Schneider, which is my most recent visit, he's trying to invest, but in everything he's doing, he still doesn't have enough resources. He still has a big unmet need. The idea that the federal government could partner, not a mandate. We wouldn't go to any state where they didn't want to partner with us. but where states wanted to expand access and make sure it's high quality, to have some federal leverage, some matching dollars there, that's a pretty attractive proposition.
I think, though, that you really do have to, because I remember talking to the federal agencies in my district, and they had done phenomenal things to improve their efficiency, and the world just didn't know it. They knew that manufacturing was doing some of those things. They didn't know that the federal agencies were doing some of those things. So I think, really, you need to work to sort of front-load your conversation about smart government. We don't want just another bureaucracy, and work with the governors to be able to help people see these savings are going to be there for you as state taxpayers and for you as federal taxpayers, but we're going to reuse the money. Your taxes won't go down, but they won't go up, but we'll have better output. Then if we need extra money, we'll talk about where that should come from. But don't lead with the tax.
For me, the challenge, I mean, the bipartisan issue is a real one. The bigger challenge for me is that most politicians, regardless of party, they're wired to think short term. You know, they think about the next election.
Right.
And this is the ultimate long-term investment. This is a 10, 20, 30, 40-year play. And the question is, you can get politicians who normally think, you know, about the next news cycle to right. think this, all the benefits, you know, President Obama will see none of these benefits during his time as president. Right. But this is arguably the biggest gift we can give to the country. So the question is, can you get politicians to think about a much longer time horizon they normally do? If we do that, this becomes, frankly, a no-brainer. If we can't do that, this one isn't going to move.
And what do you think of Mrs. Johnson's idea about a lot of discussion in the beginning, try to minimize the discussion of the tax increase and try to focus on the substance? Do you feel that that would work in the House and then Republicans in the Senate?
It's the only way we work. And again, just another example, the waivers were done around No Child Left Behind, different topic. But that's been a total bipartisan issue, whether it's South Carolina or Maryland or Michigan or Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. We partner with folks across the political spectrum in a very productive way. My whole mantra is sort of loose on means, give people lots of room to move and to be innovative and be flexible, tight on goals, have a high bar. And frankly, this has been a really underreported story by the media because there's been so little controversy. Mm-hmm. You know, all these people working together, doing all this creativity, no one's yelling and screaming at each other, so people lose interest. Mm-hmm. So I think people know we have always worked by listening very, very closely, having a high bar, giving people lots of room to move. And so this is not a new tactic or a turn for us. The only way things get done is if at the front end real input is heard, and we'll, you know, we make adjustments and we compromise and never let the perfect be the enemy of the good. But that's been our, you know, mode of operation from day one.
Another thing that's fallen through the cracks a little bit, and this administration has clearly done more than any other administration, is home visiting. And already a very large initiative. Almost every state has money from this initiative. In order to qualify for the federal money, which is a neat thing you guys do, is make them do the right thing to qualify for the money. Some people don't like that, but they organized their programs much better than they were before and coordinated them. You made them use the federal dollars only on programs that had demonstrated evidence of success and rigorous experiments. And now you're proposing another big piece of money for home visiting. Are you optimistic that that could be passed? And how does that fit into your vision?
Yeah, so again, for me, this can't be the part coming out of the Department of Education is the largest share, the $75 billion for pre-K, for four-year-olds. But this is really about a $92 billion investment, and it has to be 0 to 4. It has to be all the way 0 to 5 to get kids ready for school. But we were just talking in the car ride on the way over, you know, this idea, this reality that kids in more affluent homes, the kind of homes we grew up in Hyde Park, but by the time they're 4 years old, they have heard 30 million more words than children coming from welfare families. 30 million more words. Think about that. Think about what that does for the rest of your life.
You must live in Washington, huh?
It's 50 million more words here. And so if we're serious about closing these opportunity gaps, yes, we need high-quality pre-K at 4, but even that's late. And so getting to these, you know, young moms, getting to these teenage moms, getting these first-time parents, helping them understand that you can't just put your baby in front of the TV and you can't say bad child, bad kid all the time. Every parent wants the best for their kids. They just don't always know. So having it, you know, not at 4 years old, but at 4 days old and 4 weeks old and 4 months old, help all the way through. That can help parents who traditionally really struggle do what they want to do, which is give their child a chance at a decent life.
All right, audience, we'll give you a chance to ask questions. Now, let me caution you. Please ask a question, not make a long statement. Wait till the microphone comes. Tell us your name and where you're located, and then ask a succinct question. Somebody with a microphone is coming here.
Yeah.
Oh, right there, here. Right here in the... Thank you.
Thank you, Annabelle Fisher, Alexandria.News, but I'm also here as a licensed clinical social worker who has worked with Head Start. And my suggestions are, and having worked with Head Start, it is a good program. It has shown outcomes for pre-K. I would like to suggest that in Seattle, I did this as a home-based contractor and in the school, I would like to suggest that you raise the guidelines, the financial guidelines, so more families can participate in the Head Start program. And that will allow more families and children to get involved. It's too low right now. The second thing I would recommend
is there a question in there somewhere?
Are you going to? Oh, I better rephrase that. I'm sorry. Will you consider raising the guidelines for families to get above the low income to enter into the Head Start program? My second question: will you consider charging families of all income levels who participate in Head Start because they get everything free? And so when they, if you charge them something, if you have your very low income, 50 cents, nobody has to know how much. Once
okay,
you have to pay,
two questions,
you own
so
it. You own it, and you participate.
We've got a lot of people want to ask questions, please. So there are two questions.
I really, because I love the Head Start program, and I think there's too much duplication of services.
Ma'am, and getting can you stop, please? Hey, grab the microphone.
Grab the microphone, and don't forget the parents that need to be involved.
So a couple of things. Having not just states, but have parents have skin in the game is a really important thought in sort of figuring out how we do that. And we talk about making sure families have access up to 200% of the poverty line. People may not realize 200% of the poverty line for a family of four is like $45,000, $46,000. That's a tough living for a family of four. So we want to start with the most disadvantaged families. If states want to go beyond that, they have the right to do that. The other thing I didn't mention, if states are doing a great job in the 0-4 space, they could use our resources to make kindergarten for five-year-olds full day. So, again, we want to provide a lot of flexibility and creativity, start with the kids most in need, but work up that economic trajectory as far as we can.
Another question.
Hi, I'm Shree Chauhan, and I'm with the National Urban League. My question is, how are you going to connect some of the goals for the Head Start program with the Early Childhood Initiative? How are these things going to align together? Because there's sort of different goals for each program.
So, again, the goal would be to have HHS focus on 0-3, have over time us focus on the four-year-olds, and then have all the children. The goal is to have children entering kindergarten ready to learn and ready to be successful. That has to be the benchmark of how all these things are assessed, starting from home visiting to Head Start to pre-K. Our children entering kindergarten with the socialization and the literacy skills they need to be successful. Really quickly, we talked a lot about sort of the academic benefits, the math and the literacy. I've talked a lot to James Heckman, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist. He's a lot smarter than I am, who's done so much of this research. And it's fascinating talking to him. I'm trying to get him to break this down for me. But in terms of these long-term, four-decade-long benefits, this return on investment, he feels probably the majority of the benefit is not the academic dividends. It's the non-cognitive skills, the ability to sit in a room like this and self-regulate and have self-control, grit, resilience, and those skills that, again, frankly, in middle-class homes, there's more opportunity to learn those things. In more disadvantaged communities, there just isn't as much opportunity. So it's fascinating to me. It's not just the academic piece, but this other piece is hugely, hugely important for young people, again, not getting locked up, not becoming pregnant, graduating from high school, and getting a good job long-term.
Another question? Yes, right here in front. What is your name, young lady?
Belle Sawhill. Thank you to both of you for your terrific remarks. And I guess I want to raise two questions. One is on parenting. I understand home visiting does deal with the parenting side of this. But I was very intrigued by what Mrs. Johnson said about the fact that in healthcare there is beginning to be some experimentation with asking for more personal responsibility on the part of clients of, say, Medicaid to go along with the benefits. And I'm wondering if any thought has been given to saying in some of these early childhood programs that there would be a requirement that parents get educated and more knowledgeable about what they need to do in the home along with what needs to go what needs to happen in the early childhood program itself. I might just add as a footnote here that we have a model we've developed at Brookings, a very data-rich longitudinal model, and based on our preliminary results, it does show that early childhood education is by far the best thing we can do to provide greater social mobility, and we can show the impact of it on a social mobility matrix in America.
I really have been terribly impressed with what some of these school-based programs have accomplished in the neighborhood. The mothers with the younger siblings come in, and they have good curriculum about words and concepts and interpersonal behavior. And I think if you don't get to the whole family, then you don't build that base behind the child that supports them when they want to drop out of high school or run off and get married or whatever. So I hate to see a silo set aside for fourth grade preschool, because the challenge to our society is much more human than that. And someone once told me that you go to the obstetricians in town and they can tell you exactly which children, which parents are going to have difficulty with their children. And, you know, that is one indicator. But single parenthood is a terrible challenge for any parent of any age, and we underestimate that. So there are ways you could funnel this money into a community, or at least give the community the challenge of how would you make sure that any parent, that your physicians, any parent that... See, you could use that then not only for words, but for the mental health screen.
Yeah.
You can catch early family problems. I was chairman of the Child Guidance Clinic for many, many years at home, and we developed a program to go out and educate the parents at PTAs to just show them that you could do something about those programs. And now that there's much less prejudice on that issue, you can fold a lot of that into fourth grade education, because the parents... you can get them involved. But if you fail to get them involved, you only do half the job. So,
yeah, I think it's been a very consistent theme that's hugely, important. How do we engage parents very differently in their own children's education and in their own education? That's obviously part of Head Start's goal today and how we measure parental engagement. I want to be clear. I don't want to deny access to a child whose dad is locked up and whose mom's on crack. That's exactly the kind of child we need to serve. But we should be holding ourselves accountable for increasing parental involvement in their children's lives and in their education. One thing we haven't talked about is, again, we're really agnostic in terms of who delivers this high-quality pre-K. So it could be school systems, it could be nonprofits, it could be social service agencies, it could be churches, it could be whoever. So folks with roots in the community where there's some trust, I think that's so important to engage parents. And again, if we're trying to do this by ourselves, we'll do some good. There'll be a limit on how far we go. If we get parents actively involved and engaged, their kids, I think, are in an entirely different trajectory. And how we hold ourselves accountable, how we measure that over time, I think will be hugely important to this effort.
I would just like to add here one thing that is not well known, but the Postman School at Columbia developed a free-to-grow program that develops Head Start and is very much more effective, because it asks the questions that the whole family needs, to, that involves the whole family, like drugs and alcohol. And at first, our Head Start people were reluctant to do that. But once they got over it, they felt so much better. The families did so much better. So we become part of barriers to whole family development because we don't want to talk about the hard things. So I hope you'll look at the Free to Grow. I tried to get the Congress to lay that on Head Start, but they were...
Has to be evidence-based, though. All right. Well, Ms. Secretary, thank you very much for coming. And Mrs. Johnson,
thank you.
I really appreciate it. And please join me in thanking you.
If I could be of any help to you, be sure to let me know.
Come back.
I'm at baker.com.